This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Today, the LA City Council passed a sweeping vaccine mandate that covers a number of indoor businesses, outdoor venues, and city buildings.
Close the roll and tabulate the vote.
11 ayes, 2 noes.
Los Angeles is now the third major city after San Francisco and New York to adopt vaccine requirements on this scale. To eat at a restaurant, to get your hair cut inside, visit a museum, go bowling, see a concert or a Dodgers game, shop at a mall. If you're eligible for the vaccine, you'll have to prove that you got the shot. L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti signed the ordinance. It can go into effect as soon as the first week of November, in about a month, though the city will not actually start enforcing it until November 29th. Individual businesses, of course, can take up the rules at any time. This brings up so many questions, though, and here to break it all down is KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb. He covers the business of Southern California for us, and he's been following the story. Hey, Benjamin.
Hey there, Steve.
All right, why now? Why did city leaders feel the need to pass a vaccine mandate for all of those spaces?
Well, LA City Attorney Mike Feuer says that he thinks this is good for business. His office wrote this new ordinance.
How many of us know people, senior citizens, families, who are reluctant to go to these locations like restaurants and so on because they're not sure if other people are vaccinated or not? We will help our business community if we pass this ordinance because we're going to inspire confidence among vaccinated people.
Also, Steve, winter is approaching. The Delta variant is still circulating and case numbers are dropping, but they're still rather high. And Feuer says people also have a social obligation to do it to stop the spread of COVID.
What about those 11-year-old kids who can't get vaccinated yet? Don't you care about them? What about the senior citizen who's been shut in and suffered tremendously from social isolation for months and months and months? You have some obligation to her, too, don't you?
All right. So Mike Feuer, of course, running for mayor. He's city attorney right now. Who has to do this, Benjamin? Who needs to show proof of vaccination?
Well, the simple answer, Steve, is everyone who is eligible. And that includes anyone right now over the age of 12, unless you have a legitimate medical or religious exemption.
All right, so can I just tell the barber or the ticket taker at a Dodgers game that I have a religious exemption?
I mean, yeah, basically. I mean, the rule says you need a self-attestation that you have a religious belief or that you're allergic or whatever, so you can't get the shot. Then the business gets to decide if that's good enough for them. And if so, you must show proof of a negative COVID-19 test and a photo ID if you're over the age of 18. Note that without all of that stuff, Steve, you can still enter a business, for example, for a short amount of time to do some things like use the restroom, grab to-go orders. Also, very interestingly, Steve, these rules, they don't apply to employees at these businesses.
Wait a second. So what you're saying is if I go to get a haircut, I have to prove that I'm vaccinated with the card or whatever, but the barber does not?
Yep, and that's not true for the county vaccine mandate for bars and for wineries that we talked about last week, but this is correct for the new city ordinance.
Benjamin, when you say they want proof of vaccination, what kind of proof? Is it the card?
So yeah, your vaccine card from the CDC or the card you have from another country, that is one way. You can also show a doctor's record of your shots. If you don't have either of those, you can have a photo of that CDC card. Both sides are needed. And the last option is a digital vaccine record. These are becoming more and more common. The state of California has one. You can also use them from other states or another country. And if you got your shot in California and you want a digital copy, you can go to myvaccinerecord.cdph.ca.gov.
That's a mouthful. We're going to put that link up, by the way, at the GLA website, so if you want to take a look at that. Now the FDA, Benjamin, looks like it's going to allow kids as young as 5 to be vaccinated with an emergency authorization. Could be as soon as this month. Will the vaccine mandate then apply to children as young as 5?
It will. And the way that this ordinance is written right now, they're not going to wait for full FDA approval for kids to start requiring this. Emergency authorization will be acceptable.
So then the big question, Benjamin, is how is all of this going to be enforced?
Steve, between you and me and our listeners, It's really not, because it's up to the businesses. Bars have a guy or a gal or a person at the door. But your local nail salon, for example, normally, in fact, I would say most of them do not, right? And this is a huge concern for a number of folks, including LA City Council member Joe Buscaino, who, by the way, voted no today to pass this ordinance.
Making a teenager who, with no formal training, serve as a bouncer to keep people in or out of a restaurant and then finding the business for their failure is not the way to go about it.
Buscaino, by the way, is also running for mayor of Los Angeles. Moving on to fines, there are fines if you violate this. The first offense is a warning. The second is $1,000, and it goes up from there up to $5,000. Now, last week, the city attorney's office mentioned that LA's Department of Building and Safety could be the enforcement arm for this. Well, Steve, I reached out to them, and they said there is no way they're prepared to do that. In fact, Frank Lara with the department there, the LA Department of Building and Safety, he told me that he has just two inspectors and one senior inspector per council district to give you an idea of how enforcement might work for them.
You have done a lot of reporting on this too, Benjamin, about the business community and its response. What have you been hearing?
Yeah, for the most part, there are some positive responses to this. That includes Ruth Garcia Corrales. She runs this nonprofit called the Women's Business Center. It's in Canoga Park. And she points out that workers who deal with the public are the ones who have really gotten sick from COVID the most.
It's hard to get the right people. All the effort that you put on training them, you know, you need at least 6 months to train a new employee. Those 6 months is an investment that the small business is doing to get these people to the level they need them. Having them sick, it's a big issue because affects directly the economy of that small business.
If your workers are out, they can't come to work. That affects your business, of course. Now, Steve, there's also a lot of frustration about this mandate because the rules will be different, sometimes block by block. I mean, here's Stuart Waldman. He's the head of the Valley Industry and Commerce Association, or VICA.
Going from North Hollywood, it's a quick jump over to Burbank. And if they're not going to be enforcing the same rules, that lacks consistency.
Which is likely, Steve, to pit businesses against businesses, individuals against individuals in the short term. But let's not rule out the possibility that LA County could come in with a congruent mandate. LA City Attorney Mike Feuer declined to answer whether the city and county have been working on a joint ordinance, but they have been working in tandem throughout the pandemic, so we'll have to wait and see.
We sure will. Well, we've had to wait and see about a lot of things over the past year and a half, so here we go again. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb, who covers the business of Southern California. Benjamin, thanks.
Anytime.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Greater LA on KCRW. Military veterans make up about 3%. Of the adult population in LA County, about 250,000 people. But unless you know someone personally, you likely don't know their story. The Foxhole Theater Company wants to change that. This nonprofit aims to bridge the gap between veterans and civilians here at home and bring stories to the stage that challenge views on the military community. Stories such as The Ninth Door, which opens tonight at the Actors Company in West Hollywood. Now, in the play, nine members of a squad in Afghanistan who have all died meet again in a mystical place to complete one last mission. Matthew Domenico and Catherine Connor Duff co-founded the company and directed the play. Matthew stars in the play as well. Welcome to you both.
Hi.
Thank you so much. We're so happy to be here.
Thank you for coming on. And Matthew, I'm going to start with you because you're actually a veteran of the Afghanistan war yourself, right?
Yes, I am.
Talk a little bit about your time there and how acting has played a role in your reflection on that time.
Yeah, I was an 0311 grunt. So I was in the surge of 09, and then I was in Marja from 2010 to 2011. And then on my 09 deployment, I was combat replaced to FOB Bakwa, where I patrolled the 515, dubbed by CNN in 2009 as the world's most dangerous road. And it was just basically a giant minefield, and we had to go out there every day. And you know, when you do that kind of work, even, you know, we had a saying in the military, you know, you do something for a week straight, it becomes a routine. You do something for a month straight, it becomes a habit. You do something for 3 months straight, it becomes a life-changing aspect of who you are. And none of us have time to actually process ever out there. So coming back with acting and with theater, I've actually had time to really think about and things and process things in a very healthy way, and also realize within the community itself that they themselves are going through that process and struggling because, you know, they may not have a voice out there. So that is what the company does, giving them a voice.
Catherine, how did the two of you meet and form Foxhole?
Yeah, so we actually met in New York. We went to the same college, and we started dating, and then we started writing together shortly after that. I was majoring in playwriting. I've been a writer for years. Matthew started writing after the war to kind of process. And we reached a point in our relationship where Matthew felt comfortable telling me some dark stories and some really funny ones. And I was just thinking how theatrical and cinematic these stories were, while at the same time, Matthew was processing his military experiences and, you know, all of the things that happen to vets when they come home, and he really wanted to reach out and help vets. So we really kind of came together and decided that the best way that we thought possible to help veterans would be through art, because we really believe that art can convey a scope and feeling for events that are, you know, sometimes harder to grasp with nonfiction and harder to convey. And art allows for catharsis and pathos, which is, you know, so important in everyone's lives.
You know, the two of you are this example, right, of the veteran-civilian relationship. Matthew,
yeah.
Was it hard for you to talk to Catherine about? I mean, it is. I mean, we know that military veterans come home and sometimes they just don't want to talk about what they saw.
Oh, yeah.
And what they had to experience.
Oh, yeah. No, it was incredibly difficult. And it wasn't because I was ashamed of anything I did, or it wasn't because of anything like that. If anything, I was more worried about being judged. I was more worried about somebody who's never been in that kind of situation and immediately thinking, oh, I would have done this or I would have done that. When in fact, you know, that is one of the most horrible things about war, is you really find the true aspect of yourself. You really find that inner truth because you have split second moments to make an incredibly hard decision with no right answer on both of those options. So having to make that leap of faith, being like, you know, this girl is, you know, the best thing that's ever happened to me in my life. She's also, you know, my writing partner, my business partner, like, oh my God, I hope this doesn't ruin anything. And I think a lot of vets go through that. It's just being like, you know, can I actually make this leap of faith and it's not going to destroy anything?
And I think from the civilian perspective, like for me, what I always say to civilians that ask me, like, how can I get my veteran loved one to talk to me? You know, Matthew would always say, he would bring up something and then not explain it fully. He'd be, oh, you don't want to know what happened. It's too dark, or, you know, you don't want to hear this. And, you know, I would always say, I do. I really do want to hear it. And I'm not going to judge you. I'm not going to say anything. I just want to listen. And in listening to his stories, he was kind of able to share that burden of silence that he'd been carrying for years. And also, it's important for civilians to know what veterans went through in these foreign wars so that we don't repeat some mistakes that were made.
You guys have a podcast called Foxhole as well, right? Where vets come on and tell their stories. And I know, you know, you've been rehearsing this play for the past, well, gosh, for a while now. You've certainly been writing it for a long time, but now you see the chaos in Afghanistan. You saw the exit, pretty chaotic exit with U.S. troops, you know, withdrawing. I mean, how does that sort of jibe with what you're trying to do on stage?
Well, I mean, it's definitely trying to give back, you know, veterans, you know, an idea of pride, an idea of purpose, and also giving them a voice to what they're feeling right now. You know, we wrote this play I want to say in 2018, we were going to put it on 2019. And we originally meant it as a warning for the veteran community to get prepared, get ready for it, because, you know, we've been watching the news and it's been drawing down, drawing down. And then in the middle of production, all of this happened, and veterans are, they're going through that lost post-Vietnam phase right now. Like, what was it all for? You know, nobody knows what happened over there. And God bless the Vietnam vets that are reaching out to Afghan vets and trying to help them as much as possible. And you know, there's a lot of good work being done behind the scenes. And I'm very glad that this show that we're doing is being a part of that, is giving a voice to so many veterans who feel like it was all just for naught. And when in fact, I think there were a lot of good things that happened over there. And a lot of the, you know, men, women, and they need to be reminded of that.
The performance is called The Ninth Door. It premieres tonight at the Actors Company. It runs through October 29th, so for much of this month. Catherine Connor Duff, Matthew Domenico, co-founders of the Foxhole Theater Company here in L.A., thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Back now with Greater LA on KCRW. Steve Chiatakis here. It is sudden death baseball mode for the LA Dodgers as they try tonight to advance in the playoffs. If you're a Spanish-speaking Blue Crew-loving Angelino, you're hoping to hear a lot of this tonight.
La pelota se va, y despídala con un beso.
It's gone, say goodbye with a kiss. That's Jaime Jarin calling a glorious Dodgers home run. Jarin, the longtime Spanish language broadcaster for the Dodgers here in Los Angeles on KTNQ. And when I say long time, I mean long time. A native of Quito, Ecuador, Jarin has been calling games since 1959, the year after the Dodgers moved to L.A. He recently announced his retirement. He'll be stepping down next year in 2022, and that will be 63 years behind the microphone for the L.A. Dodgers. He's the longest active baseball broadcaster in history. Jaime Jarin, welcome to you. Congratulations on your soon-to-be retirement.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to next year. It will be my 64th.
64th. Oh, my goodness. I want to talk a little bit about your reaction to this season. A few ups and downs, obviously. Do you think the Dodgers have risen to a post-World Series winning team?
Well, I think so. Even though, you know, just one game tonight, either one can win. It's you know, sometimes the weakest team can win one game, one specific game. And they are very, very similar, those two teams, I think. So let's the Cardinals and the Dodgers tonight. It would be a very, very, very special game.
What drew you to baseball and a desire to call games for a living?
I have always been a very, very sports-minded person. When I came to this country, I had never seen a baseball game, lots of soccer games and boxing. When I came to this country, I started working at KWKW in 1955. At the end of the year, 4 months after I arrived into this great, great country, I arrived in Los Angeles on June 24, 1955, the same day that Sandy Koufax pitched his first game in the major leagues. So baseball was calling me since the day I arrived into this country. I arrived in June, and I was able to find a job with KWKW at the end of December. And I started doing boxing from the Olympic Auditorium every Thursday night. And then one day in October 1955, walking around Los Angeles, I saw that so many people were around TV sets and around radio receivers listening to this game in New York. I said, what's that? They said, that's the World Series between the Brooklyn Dodgers and the Yankees. And I said, my goodness, so many people, there were everywhere, you know, in restaurants, in businesses, in hotels, everywhere. Everybody was listening to this game in New York. So I said, that must be a great game. So I started going to the Gilmore Field and to the old Wrigley Field in Los Angeles to watch AAA baseball, trying to grab some baseball in there.
You were the news and the sports director of this little station in L.A., KWKW. Explain how you moved from news director to I'm now in the broadcast booth doing Dodgers games in Spanish.
Mr. William Beaton, who was the owner of KWKW, one day called all the employees to his office to give us the great news that he has signed a contract with the Dodgers to do games in Spanish. And he said, I need two announcers. And looking at me, he said, Jaime, I want you to be one of the two announcers. I said, thank you very much, Mr. Beaton, but I don't think that I will be able to do it right now, because even though I know some baseball, I don't have enough knowledge of the game in order to be in front of a microphone. And he liked me very much. I was 22 years old. And he said, Jaime, there's a great future for you there. You have been doing great, doing boxing. So I want you to be there next year. I'm going to give you 1 year to prepare yourself. So that year I was listening to every game on radio. Television didn't help me because there was only one game on television every week on Saturdays. And so I was reading everything about baseball, magazines, newspapers, everything. By 1959, I started with the Dodgers, doing a little bit. First, it was one inning, then 2 innings, then 3 innings. And I was the second in the booth.
I cannot believe this, but for nearly the first decade of broadcasting the games, you all didn't travel with the team, right? You would have to listen to the broadcast live in English if it was an away game, and then translate it into Spanish.
Exactly. Now, you know, they used to do that in English, but they used to be behind one inning or half an inning at least, because they were taking notes from the teletype or from the sticker. But in my case, there was no teletype or nothing. So what we had is we had a line from the ballpark to the studios at KWKW in Pasadena. And Renee and myself, we used to listen to Vin and Jerry and give practically a simultaneous translation of what was going on there. Vin was extremely helpful, because knowing our situation before the game, he will give me lots of information about the traffic, the weather conditions, the people coming to the ballpark, things like that. That helped us a lot. We had cartridges for single, double, triple, and home run. So when the game was going on, we had a big reel going on in the background, you know, all the time with noise, people noise, and that's going in every single game. In the third inning, you will hear peanuts, beer, peanuts. But when it was a complicated play, men on base, the extra base, we had to wait until the play was over to come on.
Wow. You know, Jaime, the Dodgers have a very complex relationship with the Latino community. The stadium was built on Chavez Ravine. You know the story. The city displaced a lot of people to make it happen, mostly poor immigrants, Mexican-Americans, to make way for Dodger Stadium. This is in the late 50s, early 60s. What were your feelings about it at the time?
It was a mixed feeling, because, you know, I felt for those families. But at the same time, the people was misinformed. The problem was with the city hall. They were supposed to relocate those families 15 years before the Dodgers came in. So they were the ones to blame, the councilmen and the city hall in Los Angeles, because they were supposed to relocate those families. They didn't. So, but then I think with the time, I think people have been forgetting, because at the beginning it was really, 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 it was about feelings towards the Dodgers at the beginning. But everything has been fine. I think we have worked a very good job trying to attract people to the ballpark, because, you know, when I started with Dodgers, Latinos coming to the ballpark at the Coliseum was only 8-10%.
Yeah.
And now it's between 42-46% Latinos at the ballpark. There's no other...
It's a huge, huge Latino draw. Absolutely.
Yes. There's no other segment of population that supports baseball more than the Latinos. And the Dodgers know that. And they have been able to cultivate. One of the reasons why I have stayed with the Dodgers, one of the reasons my longevity is the fact that I was able and blessed to stand into an organization that really understood the value of the Latino market. They cultivated the market. They tried to find Mexican players. I remember Mr. Walter O'Malley, the old Mr. Walter O'Malley used to walk with me in the ballpark, and he used to tell me, Jaime, when are you going to find me a Mexican Sandy Koufax? And I said, that's impossible.
But you got one eventually.
Eventually, they found one in Fernando Valenzuela. Yes, that was fine. That was great, really. My association with Dodgers has been great, really. This has been a fantastic ride for me.
It has been an amazing career for you, Jaime Hudien. I congratulate you. We honor you for so many years with the Dodgers organization. Longtime Spanish language broadcaster on AM 1020 KTNQ. Jaime Hudien, thank you for your time, sir. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Have a nice day.
A legend. Well, glad you joined us for today's episode of Greater LA. All the episodes at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. You can subscribe to the podcast, get it on the regular, fresh to your feed with every new episode, and tell us how you're doing, too. Tell us how we're doing at kcrw.com/GLA. Tomorrow, an update on the oil spill along the Orange County coast. The cleanup does continue. The impact on animals, birds especially, and the impact on business in the area hit by the pandemic. Now, again, by closed beaches. That's tomorrow on GLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all helped put the show together tonight. I'm Steve Chiatakis, honored by your presence and attention this evening. Of course, thanks for the ear. Have a great night.